Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Phyllis Bennis on the many wars in Syria, and why the only sane response is to stop fighting them and try diplomacy. I hope you'll stay tuned. Phyllis Bennis came out to Boston on the 13th of October, 2016. She gave a fine talk titled, Ending the Many Wars in Syria. The many wars now all going on at once, that is, even as we speak. Some of these are proxy wars, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, for example. But, as Bennis reminds us, these wars between other countries are being fought to the last Syrian. Phyllis Bennis is a writer and activist, a staunch progressive, and she's a very fine public speaker. I really like listening to her, and I trust you will too. Bennis has a particular interest in U.S. foreign policy, especially U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. In a recent talk on New World Notes, she described herself as a middle-class Jewish girl from California. Even so, she is known as an outspoken critic of the foreign and domestic policies of Israel, and an advocate for Palestinian rights. But today, her focus is on neither country, but a bit farther to the northeast, on Syria. Which is not to say that Israel and Palestine are irrelevant to the ongoing crisis in Syria. Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, that very good progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. She spoke at Emmanuel College in Boston on October 13. Emmanuel College is new to me. Turns out, it's a small Catholic liberal arts college, and it has a student group called Emmanuel College Peace Action, who helped sponsor Bennis's visit. Hats off to them. Hats off also to Massachusetts Peace Action, which co-sponsored the talk. Which made me think, where the heck is Connecticut Peace Action? No such critter, apparently. Even Google never heard of it. We have heard of Phyllis Bennis, though, and now we'll hear the first half of Bennis's Boston talk, and the rest next week. Ending the many wars in Syria. Here is Phyllis Bennis.
Well, thanks to Emmanuel and to Emmanuel Peace Action. This is a great chance to, I haven't been to Emmanuel before, so this is a great chance to see the school. And it's, I think, an important time for folks to be coming together to talk about the war in Syria and what it's a part of, the broader war that it's one part of, because things are going from bad to worse. Things are not getting better. And left to their own devices, our government and other governments are pretty sure to do the wrong thing rather than the right thing most of the time when it comes to these wars. So I think it's an important time to be talking about it. You know, it's difficult in a certain way to talk about the war in Syria, because the war in Syria is not a war, and it's not only in Syria, but it's part of a global war. We could identify what President Bush called the global war on terror, and the war that's raging in Syria is part of that war. The other complication is that the war in Syria is not a single war. The war in Syria is about 8 or 9 or 10 separate wars divided into two sections. So there's a civil war going on between the Syrian regime and part of its population that began, as you know, in the context of the Arab Spring in with a nonviolent uprising for asking for political reforms, quickly militarized when the regime clamped down with enormous brutality, was answered with a newly militarized movement, and morphed fairly quickly into civil war. But separate from that, there's a whole host of proxy wars being waged in Syria, whether it's between Saudi Arabia and Iran, who's going to be the regional hegemon in terms of oil and military power and economic power and political power, and in terms a sectarian war also between Iran and Saudi Arabia, whether Sunni or Shia Islam is going to be dominant in the region. Then there's wars of other forces. There's a war between the U.S. and Israel against Iran for all kinds of things. There's a war between the religious or and many of them extremist, but not all, and the secular forces within the opposition. There's several wars between Turkey and the Kurds, and there's struggles between various Kurdish forces. All of these are being waged to the last Syrian. But most of them don't have anything to do with Syria and will not do any good for anybody in Syria. There's also a war going on that has been a Cold War up until now, but is rapidly heating up. And that's the war between the United States and Russia, which is getting worse and worse in Syria. And we're hearing very dangerous developments just in the last few days. There's the good news is that Secretary of State Kerry is trying once again to get talks underway. There's some plans for talks in Lausanne in Switzerland on Saturday. Nobody is too optimistic about those talks. And in the midst of those talks, we're also hearing about new escalations on all sides, military moves that are quite threatening when there's no talks underway and no easy way out for either of these giant superpowers overarmed with military and particularly nuclear weapons. So there's some very dangerous developments underway. And the urgency, therefore, for reaching some kind of negotiated ceasefire, arms deal, arms control, and ultimately diplomatic solution becomes more urgent than ever. So the context of all this, and I'll get into a little bit of the detail, not too much, but the context of it all is what President Bush called the global war on terror. Now, you remember, some of you, most of you are too young to remember, but you've probably read about it. After 9/11, the day after, even the day of, we heard from President Bush there was a choice, that Americans had a choice. We could either go to war or let them get away with it. It was war or nothing. And since most people didn't want to just say, let them get away with it, do nothing, a lot of people supported war who might otherwise have been against it. Why would they have been against it? Well, to start with, none of the hijackers were from Afghanistan. None were Afghans. They were mainly Saudis and a couple of Egyptians. They didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Hamburg. They didn't train in Afghanistan. They trained in Florida. They didn't go to flight school in Afghanistan. They went to flight school in Minnesota. So what were we doing bombing Afghanistan? Because they were inspired by somebody who was holed up in Afghanistan. But we also know that a big part of the reason for the war in Afghanistan, aside from revenge, despite the rhetoric, this was never a war for justice. This was a war for revenge. But it was also a war to prepare the political ground for a war in Iraq. Now, why? Because there were weapons of mass destruction. Oh, no, that's wrong. It's because Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. Oh, no, that's not quite right. Except a lot of people in this country still think that's true, because we were told it over and over and over again by people in Washington who most people in this country like to assume knew something more than we knew, had access to more information than we knew, or some version thereof. So the global war on terror is launched. And what we see is that the U.S. has been at war with terrorism for 15 years, and terrorism is doing just fine. Terrorism is thriving. The people and the cities and the countries where this so-called war against terrorism is being waged, they're not doing so well. People are being killed. Cities are being destroyed. The levels of instability and violence and chaos have escalated throughout an enormous and expanding region. Now, to his credit, and it's about the only thing I want to give him credit for here, President Bush understood what he was doing, and he called it a global war, exactly what it was. President Obama, when he was elected on a platform of ending what he called the dumb war in Iraq and promising, as he did, to expand the smart war in Afghanistan, something he did, that was a promise kept. I think too many people sort of skipped that part when they were looking at his anti-war credentials and saying, great, he's going to end the war in Iraq, and not looking at the other side of it. But on the second day after he came into office, the Obama administration sent out a memo to the White House and to the Pentagon and to the State Department, to, you know, pretty much everybody, saying, we would rather that you not call this the global war on terror. We would rather use the term overseas contingency operation. Now, it's pretty Orwellian. You know, it's this anodyne description, overseas operation. It's kind of, you know, the global fire truck getting the kitten out of the tree. When I heard it, I thought, well, that's what you do, like, if you send the Navy to rescue people off the coast of Haiti who have been displaced from the hurricane. That's an overseas operation, right? This is a war, and he should call it a war. Now, it's not the same kind of war. It's quite different. It doesn't involve hundreds of thousands of ground troops, as George Bush's war did. But there is no question this is a war. Just ask anybody in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Djibouti or Somalia or Libya or any of these countries where these wars are being waged. So what we have is the continuation of a global war on terror, but one that is not identified as a full-scale war, despite the costs to the people and cities and countries where it's being waged, and ultimately the costs here at home in the discrediting of our government and our policies, in the financial costs, which I'll get to later. But we're seeing all of this at a moment when the U.S. is expanding militarism around the world. It isn't only in the war theater of the broader Middle East. It's also the militarization of foreign policy, where extreme sanctions that are crippling for ordinary people and military threats and the escalation of military capacities around the world take the place of a diplomatic focus for diplomacy, for foreign policy. So the irony is, of course, when we look at when, and we're hearing a lot now about President Obama's legacy, he's in his last few months of office, he's thinking about legacies, other people are writing about his legacy. He's got some things to be very proud of that are based on the triumph of diplomacy over war. He can point to the Iran nuclear deal, which was a hard-fought accomplishment against massive opposition in Congress, massive opposition from Israel, massive political opposition. But they got it through, and it's been a remarkably powerful, strong, negotiated deal. Has its problems, but it's avoided what was a potentially devastating war. He can point to Cuba, where after 50 years of crippling sanctions and a blockade, we're not all the way there yet. We don't have full normalization yet. But the U.S. is well on its way towards normalizing relations with Cuba. And all of that was done without firing a shot, eliminating the worst of the sanctions. Not all, but we're on the way. If you look at everywhere where the military has been the centerpiece of our policy, we've failed. And this global war on terror, it didn't just fail in some broad rhetorical sense. Yes, we've been at war with terror for 15 years and terrorism is doing just fine. I kind of like that line. It's quite accurate. But it isn't just that broad framework. It's also the failures you can point to in every one of those countries where that war has been waged. So start with Afghanistan, where we first went to war for the global war on terror. We've been having troops in Afghanistan for almost 15 and a half years now. You know, it's an extraordinary thing. At the end of the day, what do we see in Afghanistan? We see massive failure. Just last week, the Central Command reaffirmed that as of now, the Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan than at any time since the U.S. overthrew the Taliban back in 2001. Great. 15 years of occupation have done great. And then you hear, well, at least the girls can go to school. At least children can get an education, which they couldn't under the Taliban. Well, there were plenty of problems under the Taliban. It was a repressive, horrific, misogynistic regime, no doubt. But what we've got now in a government led by corrupt politicians and a bunch of warlords whose own religious and political views are very, very similar to those of the Taliban. We just heard from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan that over 42% of the children of Afghanistan have either never gone to school, or if they went at all, they were forced to leave school by the fifth grade at the most. Most have gotten no education at all. Why? Because most of the schools that were supposedly being built at enormous expense with our tax money by U.S.-paid contractors were simply never built at all. The few that were often collapsed in the first winter because they weren't built to withstand it, and they have no teachers. So the whole question of how the U.S. tried to operate in Afghanistan has been a fraud. It has accomplished nothing. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, Afghanistan was, according to UNICEF, the worst country in the world for a child to be born and survive to her first birthday, and the worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive. Today, it's still the worst country in the world for a woman to, I shouldn't say today, this was about 6 months ago, it may have changed by now, but it was still the worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive, and the second worst country in the world, Sierra Leone, came out ahead, if you will. So that's what we have to brag about after 15 years of military occupation. In Iraq, the next, if we go chronologically, the next country for the global war on terror, we see a government that is so incompetent that there is still only 6 or 7 hours of electricity for anybody in Baghdad and 4 or 5 or less for anybody else in the country. They've never been able to get the electricity working again after the war. And so incredibly sectarian as a Shia-dominated government and brutal in its treatment of the large Sunni minority that a ton of Sunni, ordinary Sunni Iraqis are turning to ISIS as the lesser evil. Not because they're extremists, not because they're religious fanatics. I mean, I've met some of these Sunni generals. They are as secular as they come. They drink, they smoke, God knows what else they do. But they are not religious anything. But they are turning to ISIS because they see it as the potential for maybe they could get some support, some defense of their community against a sectarian government put in place, armed and paid by the United States with our tax money, despite the fact that they're more accountable to Iran than they are to us. But that government has been so repressive against ordinary Sunnis, from roundups of young Sunni men on the streets, torture in the prisons, bombing of a Sunni nonviolent protest camp. It's been really grim. So people are turning to ISIS and saying, well, maybe that's where we could get some kind of hope, some kind of support against this government. It's been a complete failure. In Yemen, Yemen's the poorest country in the Arab world, has been for decades. 80% of the population now is completely dependent on food for survival from the United Nations. The economy has been destroyed. People are being held in towns that have been under siege by the Saudi-led coalition that is dropping bombs that we provide from planes that we provide that are fueled in the air by our planes and our pilots. And we read in the New York Times today that for the first time, the U.S. is engaging in the war in Yemen. And I wanted to yell at somebody at the Times and say, what do you think in-air refueling is? Chop liver? You know, it's like, what are you people thinking? This is the first time. They have been engaged in this war for the entire 15 months this war has been waged. What they did do for the first time today, or I guess yesterday, was to directly bomb the rebel forces in Yemen who are fighting back against the Saudi coalition bombing, who tried to bomb a U.S. warship and failed, and the U.S. went and bombed Yemen and took out 3 targeting things of some sort. I'm not quite sure what they were. Radar systems on the Yemeni coast. So now the U.S. is clearly fully directly involved. It certainly isn't the first time, as I mentioned earlier. But it has been an absolute failure. The Saudi war has led to enormous civilian casualties. You all know about the bombing of the funeral parlor 3-4 days ago now, where 140 people were killed right off the cuff. Another 500 to 600 have been injured, some of them badly enough that they will probably not survive. So the entire escalation of the Saudi war in Yemen is going forward with full U.S. backing, U.S. support. In Libya, again, in the context of the Arab Spring, a crisis in Libya that leads to a call for a familiar word, a no-fly zone. And first the call comes from various European powers. It's quickly taken up in the U.S. by the then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and others in the State Department. Hillary Clinton, who's supposed to be at that time the diplomat in chief, you would think she would have been calling for a diplomatic solution, but no, she was the one leading the call for a no-fly zone. The Secretary of Defense, the head of the Pentagon, who one would think would be calling for the military side, he was the one saying, no, we shouldn't be engaging. Why? Because he said, establishing a no-fly zone in Libya starts with going to war against Libya. This is Robert Gates in whatever it was, April or May of 2011, the Secretary of Defense. The Republican, he was the holdover from the Bush administration. President Obama had kept him on. And he's the one saying, it means we have to go to war with Libya. Why? Because the first thing you have to do in establishing a no-fly zone is take out the anti-aircraft system so that your patrols will be safe. Now, Libya at that time barely had an anti-aircraft system of any significance. But nonetheless, they went forward. Secretary Gates' position was defeated. Secretary Clinton's position was the one that ruled the day. The U.S. joined NATO and in a massive bombing campaign that, of course, led to the overthrow and ultimately the murder of Gaddafi. And crucially for the regional situation, as well as inside Libya, led to the throwing open of the doors of massive arms depots throughout the country. Those arms have now surfaced all throughout Central Africa, North Africa, throughout the greater Arab world. Basically, in all these conflicts, there are now Libyan arms that have been made available to pretty much anybody. Inside Libya, massive instability and massive violence, three separate governments, none of whom have any indigenous credibility. One is recognized by the UN, but none of them are seen as representing a unified country. It's a disaster. The disaster is not about the Hillary Clinton emails about Benghazi. That's not the disaster. The disaster is for the people of Libya and what's happened to their country. A lot of people at the time said that a no-fly zone is going to lead to regime change. And in the UN Security Council, the same argument was made. And people were somehow convinced that, no, this is only about protecting civilians. This is not about regime change. And what a surprise. It got bad enough that the Secretary General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in South Africa, which voted for the resolution authorizing this so-called no-fly zone to protect civilians, later apologized, said we should have known better. We should have known it would not be limited to a no-fly zone to protect civilians, that it would become regime change, and indeed it did. Syria, the centerpiece now of the worst of all of this, also in the context of the Arab Spring, begins with a nonviolent protest movement of Syrians fed up with a very brutal dictatorial regime, looking for political reforms, an end to mass arrests, an end to torture in prison, exacerbated somewhat by conditions created by climate change. When, you know, in the Arab Spring was a regional phenomenon, but it took very different form in different countries. And in Syria, one of those forms had to do with climate change, because there had been a three-year drought that led 800,000 Syrian farmers and their families to be driven off the land. They could no longer make a living. They were forced into the cities looking for work. Until about 10 years earlier, they might have found jobs, because at that time, the Syrian economy was a kind of state socialism of a sort, with a very enormous, bloated state sector that could, you know, hire pretty much anybody they wanted. About a decade before, it had turned into a kind of neoliberal economy where there was a great deal of privatization. The state sector had been vastly diminished. So people flood into the cities looking for work. There's hardly any jobs. The jobs they do find tend to go to people who know someone in power. That means they're more likely than not to be an Alawite, because that's the religious identity of the ruling family, of the Assad family, and their closest circles. It doesn't mean that only Alawites got jobs, but it just means that it exacerbated the sectarianism that had not been a big issue in Syria historically. Historically, Syria, modern Syria, had been quite secular. But suddenly, sectarianism was a big factor. So you see in Syria, with the rise of ISIS, first in Iraq, the rise of ISIS, of course, one of the consequences of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It emerged from a U.S.-run prison, Camp Buqqa, in Iraq, where hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of Iraqis were rounded up and imprisoned. And let me just ask you something about this. This happened in 2004, in the first year of the U.S. war in Iraq. And at the time that the group that became ISIS, it didn't use that name at first, it was attached to Al-Qaeda earlier, it was much less religiously focused in its earlier iterations. But at that time, it was the same time as the Abu Ghraib scandal emerged. Now let me ask the students here, how many of you have heard of Abu Ghraib? Just a couple of you. You should raise this with some of your faculty here, because that's a problem that you don't know more about Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib is something that will haunt United States foreign policy for generations. Abu Ghraib was a prison in Iraq, where Iraqis that were picked up by the U.S. occupation forces were held and interrogated, and it turns out, humiliated and tortured routinely by U.S. soldiers. This had been going on in other prisons as well. It wasn't unique to Abu Ghraib. What was unique was that a set of photographs were leaked from Abu Ghraib. And those photographs made it onto the front page of every newspaper in the country and around the world. And those photographs showed U.S. soldiers, very young U.S. soldiers, humiliating, helpless, often naked Iraqi prisoners, sometimes with a dog collar around their neck and held on a dog leash, sometimes forced to pile on top of each other in piles of naked men. It was unspeakable humiliations and unspeakable torture. Every Iraqi prisoner in a U.S. prison in those days knew that he might face the same torture. Not everyone was, but they all knew it could happen because it had happened, it had been documented, and the whole world now knew about it. It's now the symbol for Iraqis of what the U.S. occupation looked like. So in that context, that's what led to the creation of what became ISIS. ISIS becomes strong for some of the reasons I mentioned. Iraqis who are very secular in other ways, and some of them are generals, some of them have their arms, join with ISIS. They become much stronger than they would on their own. They're powerful because they don't fight alone. And suddenly they're over the border into Syria, wiping out the colonial border and saying, we are establishing this caliphate on territory across both Iraq and Syria. So the Syria war takes on this incredibly complex character. It's no longer just either a political or even an armed struggle between opposition forces and the regime. There's now both Syrian but especially regional Islamist forces, extremist forces flooding into Syria as well as into Iraq, and then global Islamist forces are coming in to join, to be part of this caliphate. So it complicates everything as we move towards the period where we see these proxy wars that I mentioned earlier.
Phyllis Bennis with part one of Ending the Many Wars in Syria. She spoke in Boston on October 13, 2016. Many thanks to Dave Goodman of IBIS Radio for the fine recording. That's www.ibisradio.org. And we are at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimate non carborundum, reminding you that an injury to one is an injury to all, and hoping you'll tune in again next week, when we'll have part two of Bennis's talk. Y'all come back now here. Ciao.